So if you take your mind back to before the Industrial Revolution, the average laborer only worked 4 hours a day, and they had their priorities absolutely the right way around, in my never humble opinion. They had family, leisure, church, work. That was the order. And today it's work, 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 to hell with the rest, right? But that's just an afterthought. And I never wanted that because I'm basically a lazy guy, and I like lying in a hammock, and I don't want to be grinding at the wheel, so to speak. So then, you know, 1740, some bright spark invented the spinning jenny. Seemed like a good idea. And then another bright spark came in and said, why don't we put all the spinning jennies in one place? We'll call it a factory. And then they thought, but we don't have any source of artificial light yet. That's 200 years away. So we need to keep the factories working all daylight hours. And then suddenly this village-centric world where people had perfect lives, almost idyllic, utopian sort of lives, they end up learning this thing called commuting. And then they learn this thing called squalor, and they hang out around the machines, and shifts are invented, and they're doing 10, 12, 14 hour shifts, which is ridiculous. So historically, that wasn't the way. Today, I think that's normal, but it's normal for the machines, but it's not normal for humans. And it's certainly not normal for the brain.
Welcome. We tell ourselves that burnout is proof of ambition, but is it? Or is it our nervous system crying out for help while we pretend that it's courage? For decades, we have glamorize this biological failure state. Leaders brag about exhaustion the way teenagers brag about bad decisions. We tell ourselves and anyone who will listen that exhaustion is noble. It's not noble. It's biochemical chaos. The science is blunt. Chronic stress rewires your brain towards fear, not brilliance. It shrinks the hippocampus. It throttles creativity. It hijacks your brain so that everything feels like a threat. And it turns down the prefrontal cortex, which is the seat of real leadership. It turns it into an old tired dog that can barely fetch a bone of clear thinking. Yet leaders cling to the fantasy that suffering equals progress. It's the oldest neurological con in the book, the survival response dressed up as strategy. Today's guest does not play that game. In fact, his existence exposes the entire fraud. Trevor Blake has built and sold multiple nine-figure companies, without traditional entrepreneurial warfare. No employees, no office, no hustle culture, no hustle theater, no cholesterol-fueled chest pounding, and absolutely no burnout masquerading as discipline. He operates with something far more subversive: coherence, internal regulation, and strategy without self-harm. It's a way of working that makes the old guard nervous, but proves that they've been paying emotional interest on a debt they never needed to exist. More about Trevor Blake in a moment. Welcome to the Off Baron Show. Come for the stories, stay for the truth that give birth to new meaning. I'm your host, Dov Baron. I work with the elite leaders and organizations who are quietly bending the trajectory of industries and entire nations. My work is in helping you diagnose and rewire your emotional source code so you can stop unconsciously leading from your oldest wounds in your nervous system. When you stop leading from your old scars, you start leading from truth, from meaning and purpose, and the truth that alters everything from your vision, your values, your worthiness, and your biology. Now, let's get back to Trevor Blake. He launched his first company with nothing but a laptop and converted it into a nine-figure exit. Then he did it again and again. He is dangerous to hustle culture because what he has built, it actually scales, built on what actually works for the human brain: alignment, coherence, and momentum without self-destruction. He is the proof that force makes you predictable and tired, and that real leverage points to the state of your nervous system. If you are the kind of leader who wants depth over dopamine hits, hit that subscribe button right now. This is where serious thinkers come to sharpen their edge and conformists get uncomfortable. You're about to question the beliefs that you've been burning through your potential for years. You may not like the answers, but if you take them on, you are going to love the results. Turn up the volume and help me to welcome New York Times bestselling author of Three Simple Steps, Trevor Blake. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Dove. That's probably the best intro I've ever had. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, mate. It's good to have you here. You know, there's a lot to talk about here. You and I have had some previous conversations, and there's so much to talk about the way you do things differently. And I think that we've all sort of grown up in this idea of hustle culture, and you've got to push to the grindstone. What key belief did you have to abandon to truly build companies on your terms? i.e. no employees, no office, and certainly no burnout.
That none of this is new. So the funny thing is that I have an ebook on trevorgblake.com, my website. It's free. I wrote it in COVID, and it was the practical magic of the five-hour workday. Not to only work 5 hours, but how you structure your day. Time to work, time to relax, time to work, time to switch on, switch off, which is how the brain works. And the funny thing is, it was a revelation to people, and most people didn't want to believe it, but it's actually historical. So if you take your mind back to before the Industrial Revolution, the average laborer only worked 4 hours a day, and they had their priorities absolutely the right way around, in my never humble opinion. They had family, leisure, church, work. That was the order. And today it's work, 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 to hell with the rest, right? But that's just an afterthought. And I never wanted that because I'm basically a lazy guy and I like lying in a hammock and I don't want to be grinding at the wheel, so to speak. So then, you know, 1740, some bright spark invented the spinning jenny. Seemed like a good idea. And then another bright spark came in and said, why don't we put all the spinning jennies in one place? We'll call it a factory. And then they thought, but we don't have any source of artificial light yet. That's 200 years away. So we need to keep the factories working all daylight hours. And then suddenly this village-centric world where people had perfect lives, almost idyllic, utopian sort of lives, they end up learning this thing called commuting, and then they learn this thing called squalor, and they hang out around the machines, and shifts are invented, and they're doing 10, 12, 14-hour shifts, which is ridiculous. So historically, that wasn't the way. Today, I think that's normal, but it's normal for the machines, but it's not normal for humans, and it's certainly not normal for the brain. And I got lucky here because my first sort of grown-up job was I left school and I joined the Royal Navy. And the military is pretty smart when understanding what's peak brain performance, what works, what doesn't work. And they know it's not a good idea if an officer falls asleep on the bridge in an armed warship. It's not going to end very well, right? So you do watches. You do 4 hours on, 4 hours off, 2 hours on, 2 hours off. And the question was, okay, what do you do in the off? Well, they didn't let you sit on a sofa watching TV. You learn, you read, you practice, you go through standing orders and all this kind of stuff. But you need that off time in order to refuel the brain to get it back to peak performance. And so even today, the military works that way. NASA has all its pilots work that way. They are forced to take a nap after working for 4 hours. And so I just had this in my life. And people thought I was smart, but I wasn't. I was just working differently to the way they were working. And so as I've gone through life, I've worked that kind of process, that discipline, that structure in the corporate world. Now, you very kindly were promoting me as a serial entrepreneur. I didn't start that till I was 43. Before that, I had the classic fast-track career. And I went from, this was in England, so I went from a trainee sales rep in Liverpool for a pharmaceutical company to vice president commercial development at a Seattle biotech in 6 years. And during that corporate career, I had to pretend that I was working 10-hour days. And what I used to do is I used to go and get a file. I put a little piece of plain white paper in it, and I'd look at it, and I'd frown, and it looks like this is the end of the world for this company. And I'd shake my head. I'd walk fast through the office. That was a trick I learned. The faster you walk, the busier you seem. And so I'd walk fast through the office, straight out the fire escape, down into my car, drive home, and relax for 2 hours. From all through that career, I won every sales prize that was going. I was regional manager of the year 4 years running. I was European manager of the year for 3M, which is a Fortune 100 company, massive 100,000 employees. And nobody knew my secret, which was cheating, basically. I just worked 4 or 5 hours a day. When I started as an entrepreneur, it was easy to fall into the trap of forgetting my secret in the most entrepreneurs, and I don't know if you do the same thing, Dove, you know, sit in front of your computer waiting for an email, or you wait for the phone to go. And if it doesn't go and you don't get an email, you think, I'm not very good at this. I must be a terrible business person. And I fell into that trap and I got burned out really quickly.
So at this point, you've just begun your entrepreneurship.
Yeah. I made the same mistake that everybody's making.
But you started out in the corporate world following your own system. Then you abandoned your own system as you went into your own entrepreneurial business. Do you think that that was the sort of indoctrination that you're on the grindstone, you're supposed to hustle like crazy?
I think it is. I think also it's the pressure we put ourselves under. I've got no one to blame now. I can't fire anybody. I've got no employees. I've got no boss to impress, you know, with the bullshit that we all talk around the board table and everything. And so now the buck stops here. As an entrepreneur, and in this case, working from home, because I didn't have the money to work from somewhere else, working from home and just sitting there staring at a computer thinking I'm not very good at this, I got burned out quickly. My life was saved by my wife, because one of the things I noticed today is this hustle culture, I call it hustle porn, actually. The Hormozes and people of the world, that you can definitely be successful hustling. I'm not against them. I'm not saying they're wrong. But look at their personal lives.
Yeah, they don't have a life.
Look at their health. And so, you know, read the Elon Musk biography and you think, okay, man's a genius, done incredible things, but I would not want to have his life. Thank you very much. His personal life or his health. I do not want to be waking up at 2 a.m, projectile vomiting from nerves. I like the relaxation. I've had two wives in my life. The first one, I was married 1 month off 40 years. She died in 2020. I'm blessed to have met somebody else. We're now 3 years old. Both of them remind me on a constant basis what happened to the 5-hour workday when I forget the 5-hour work.
Right.
And so I remember one time Lynn came into the spare bedroom I converted into an office and she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm working." She said, "No, you're staring at a laptop." I said, "No, I'm working." She was never interested in what I did, and suddenly she was. So I said, "I'm building this company and it's unique. It's never been done before." And she said, "Yeah, but I don't see you. I never see you. The dogs have forgotten who you are." And so she said, "Go back to the way you used to work and it'll all be fine." And it wasn't easy making the switch. And so anyone who's listening to this, I'm not saying it's easy to go from the hustle culture to the non-hustle culture, but you can introduce it slowly.
So let's just put a pause there for a minute, because I think you've just said something that's quite profound. So again, you were doing the 5-hour work week. You enter into the entrepreneurial world. You enter into the hustle culture. Lynn helps you to recognize that that's not the way to go. You understand this because you and I have talked a lot about brain chemistry. At a neurochemical level, it becomes addictive to work that way. And so you're kind of withdrawing, like take the needle out of this cortisol of being stressed out all the time and then pulling yourself off that. It can be very difficult for people. And the reason it can be difficult is because there's a lot of identity embedded in being the hustle worker. So in that position, did you feel that?
Yeah, I mean, that dopamine hit, it's a definite addiction. We kid ourselves. So we substitute the words, you know, we don't say to ourselves, "Oh, I'm having a dopamine hit." We say, "Oh, I'm in the zone." And you're not. After 2 hours, neuroscience and neuroplasticity proves that the brain starts to diminish very quickly. And we start to multitask and we think that's possible. Physically, it's impossible, by the way. It's called context shifting. You know this as well as I do. So I'm a physicist, so I'm fascinated by why things work or don't work. So that's why I'm fascinated by the brain. And that's why I have my course, The Transformation Experience, which if anyone's interested, it goes into all of this stuff. It's at trevorgblake.com. And what we do is we go in to find out, okay, how does the brain work? How does the nervous system work? How does energy work? We match ourselves according to that. And when we match ourselves and we feel good about the match, we definitely immediately start to slow down. When we slow down, we don't get the dopamine hit so much. So there's an adjustment period. That's why I'm even in personal development, because it's all about dopamine hits. And I've got friends who have spent probably $200,000 on courses and books and seminars and webinars and walking on calls and all that crap that they've been doing for years and nothing has changed in their lives, not one thing. We talk about it and it's because they get this dopamine hit that makes them feel good for a period of time, makes them feel better about their life for a period of time. That's what I got as an entrepreneur when I first started. I felt good about myself because I'm an entrepreneur, but wasn't very productive and certainly the company was struggling. And then when I got rid of that kind of addiction to the dopamine hit, and I actually went back to structuring my day 2 hours on, religiously after that 2 hours, switch off, no matter what's happening. So if I'm in the middle of a phone call or a conference, it stops, it's gone. And then what do I do with that time? I will take quiet time, which is my version of meditation. I'll go for a walk in the woods. I sometimes will take a nap. Other times I'll go and have a shower. I have a friend who's incredibly successful, a multi-billionaire, and that's what he does. He makes himself shower 5 times a day, not because he smells, but because that's where the magic happens.
I was gonna say, he's not a stinky guy.
No, maybe he knows something that, you know, it's the secret. I don't know. But he does it on purpose, and he says that's where all the magic happens. He switches off. And that's all this is about. It's nothing clever. It's nothing new. Like I say, it's ancient.
Let's go on a little bit, because last time we spoke, you were traveling, trying to decide where to live because you were looking for what's the next place to settle. You talked about being a physicist. You've talked about being an entrepreneur. But I'd like people to understand where you came from, because you and I come from very close to each other. We were born around the same part of Britain. And in that world, when we grew up, there were very few people who escaped. I think, as far as I know, apart from one cousin, I was the only person who escaped the environment I grew up in. And I don't mean there was a wall around it. It's a mental wall. And she escaped. She went to Oxford and she became a PhD. And then she went right back to Salford. So I left and everybody still doesn't understand why. For you, what got you to understand the restrictions of that environment and that world and what it offered you and then pulled you into another reality?
That's a fantastic question. I'll keep it as short as I can. I have a book called Three Simple Steps. It's, you mentioned at the beginning, New York Times bestseller. A lot of this story is in there, and people find it inspiring because it gives them the hope of being able to get out of what you've just been describing, which I call quicksand. If you look from the outside, you'd say, okay, Trevor Blake grew up really poor. A father who was unemployed and unemployable, not a bad guy, didn't drink or anything, smoked a lot. That killed him in the end, but he just gave up on life and he liked to read. So he sat at home reading and drawing down welfare. My mother was dying of cancer. She was given 6 months to live when I was just a nipper. But she fought really hard and she was my biggest inspiration. So I'm very fortunate in life to have been inspired by this very powerful feminine energy. And then she introduced me to Lynn. Lynn was her chemotherapy nurse. And then Lynn introduced me to Jess, ironically, who I'm married to now, when Jess was working for Disney. I had her as a guest on one of my masterminds. And so I've been guided by that feminine power through my life, which I know makes me a really lucky guy. But I get what you're saying. So when you grow up poor like that and the world is looking in at you, they provide you a trajectory and they say, okay, forget ambition, especially in England, right? If you say in England, I want to be an astronaut, they say, nah, I'll tone it down a little bit. We're not astronauts.
It's what we talk about in Aussie as in the tall poppy syndrome. You pop your head up and you're going to get your head lopped off. So you keep your head down and you play small and you go down the pub and you have a couple of pints and you complain about the government and you complain about the football and that's it.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened to me. Not the pub thing, I was too young, but I popped my head up. I made the mistake of announcing to my teachers and classmates that this wasn't for me. The school counselor offered me an application form to be an apprentice manager at a chicken packing factory in Denby, North Wales. And I can't repeat on air what I said to that. I mean, that's how they saw me. And it was such a shock because I saw myself through my mum's eyes. And my mom saw this talent and she said, you know, you can be anything you want. Just hold your head up high, look the world in the eye, you can do anything. And I believed her because she's my mom. I wanted to be an officer in the Royal Navy and everyone laughed. My teachers laughed, my colleagues laughed, the kids in the school laughed.
But what was it about the Navy? Why the Navy?
Travel. So the thing is about when you grow up poor, we never had a holiday. And I saw all these people going off on holidays, even if it was just to a caravan at the coast. You know, I was so envious of them. I mean, I wouldn't go there. They'd pay me $1 billion now. No, I'm not going to do that. But at the time, that was huge.
We could have gone to Blackpool and been on the beach with the donkeys and donkey poo. That's where we went.
That's one of my intentions in life. I long for those things, though. So the thing is, you get to a certain age, well, that becomes nostalgic.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. No, it's a good story.
Yeah. So I wanted to join the Navy and everyone said, no, people like you from this part of the world, it doesn't happen. It's elitist. You can't. Maybe you can become a grunge guy. None of that interests me. I wanted to be an officer. I'd seen that there was a TV program, a series called The Sailor. Rod Stewart had the theme music to it. And I just loved it. And my stomach would turn over and I get so excited. So I'm going to do that. And you know what? My mum and I together made it happen. And that released me from quicksand for the rest of my life. So then I knew I can do anything. If I could do that, I can do anything. 17.
So you're 17, you joined the Royal Navy. How do you go from Royal Navy to physicist?
So they trained me. He saw something no one else saw, which was, you got some brain cells between your ears. And I said, yeah, I think I do. This was the late 70s, and they're moving to a more technological military. And so you needed these technological skills that no one ever needed. Before, all you had to do is point and shoot. Now you've got to actually press some buttons and turn some keys. And so they were training the future of the Royal Navy. And so I got involved in radiation physics, which was fascinating to me. I just loved it. Turned out to be something I was really good at. And then I finished off that degree when I left the Royal Navy and joined the health service. I added a second degree in nuclear medicine. So I had this really unique combination of radiation physics and nuclear medicine, which helped me see the world in a different way. And in a simple way, which is basically, if we interact with energy in a different way, we get different results. And I can use that. You know, I don't have to go back to the quicksand. I don't have to go back and live in that old farmhouse. I can keep moving forward and having fun and adventure. And that's how I got on the fast track career, just learning how to interact with energy in a different way. And then that's how I built all my companies. I know, by the way, company number 7.
That's interesting what you're saying about the interaction with the energy, because I think that you have a way of looking at things that a lot of people don't, and that's a good thing. But in your numerous adventures, your successes, can you recall a specific quote-unquote failure or missed opportunity that ultimately opened an unexpected door that shaped your philosophy and the way that success alone maybe couldn't up?
Yeah, every single time. That's a really insightful question again. So this is good. I'm enjoying this good chat. I feel like we should have a fireside and a couple of glasses of wine or something.
Sounds good to me.
I don't like the labels of success and failure. So I never look at either of them that way. Other people have those judgments. That's fine. I just do something and then go and do something else and then go somewhere else. And when other people look at things and see it as failure, I call it the winding staircase. Like, not everything goes in a straight line or at a 45 degree angle. If anyone who's watching or listening this looks back at the best thing that happened in their life, try and trace it. There's no straight line. It's, oh, if I hadn't been in that space, I wouldn't have met that person. If I hadn't have tripped over and spilled wine on that person, that wouldn't have happened. And you see this kind of sort of jigsaw approach to life, and then it happens. So for me, every time I've missed an opportunity, it's become not just an opportunity to learn, but I've looked back and said, I'm glad I missed it because something else would have happened. Not a bad thing, just it would have been something else. My classic example, which this would make a lot of people cry, I think, and it makes me cry thinking about it, is I tried to buy $10,000 worth of Bitcoin when it was 12 cents. In order to buy it in those days, you had to go on to the different internet, the dark internet.
Dark web.
Yeah, that's it. I wasn't comfortable doing that. And then somebody was going to produce the codes for me. I didn't really understand it all, but I really like everything that's decentralized. So this appealed to me. Decentralized finance appealed to me. And so growing up in a village, I'm not one for government and authorities and stuff like that. Where a village manages itself. So I know the power of that, and I've always been fascinated by it. But the thing was, I had to meet this guy in an alley, and he had a newspaper, literally, and in the newspaper were the codes. And they put me off. I'm not going to do that. And hand over 10,000 in cash. If I had, though, Dove, that's worth $6 billion today, right?
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I might not have held on to it. So I think about things like that. Instead of being negative about it and saying, oh, what a missed opportunity, I've stayed fascinated by cryptos. And I'm probably the oldest crypto guy out there. People come in for crypto advice, and it makes me smile because the only reason I have advice to give is because of the negative lesson I had.
Yes.
Of missing the opportunity. And then when I got back in, it took kahunas to get back in because it was at $3,000. So to pass up on something at a few cents, 12 cents, and then come back in later and says, I still believe in this because I actually understand it now, and it's going to cost me 3,000 per Bitcoin. You know, then that takes a lot of, I don't know what the right word is, but it takes a lot to admit a mistake and go back in and do it again. But that's incredibly valuable when we're, like you and I, were building companies. I miss things all the time. I make what other people call mistakes all the time and miss opportunities. And the best business advice I was given, and I can pass on to anybody, is not to try and figure out the how or the why. Just get in. And when you're in, it always goes in a different direction than you ever expected. So all that planning is a waste of time anyway. And that's where the fun starts. So I really should have just got in Bitcoin at the beginning and had fun.
But that's the willingness to trust. Do you not think that that's the willingness to trust that the path is always opening up before you rather than you have to plan the path? You plan the direction, but not the path, that the path is opening and it's going to wind and it's going to twist. And I think that that takes us out of the mindset of accidents or, for that matter, of quote, failure or success. Before we continue, I want to speak to the listener and say that part of you that's not here by accident, maybe you think it's an accident, but there's a part of you that knows leadership is not a role, it's an initiation. And if you're listening to this show, you're already standing out from the many. That's my guess. There's another level, a level where your nervous system steps up. It reacts to life and starts redirecting it. Very few people cross the threshold. But if you are one of those few, and if you want to be part of our inner circle, go to DoveBaron.com. You can join those doing the real work, making the biggest difference, the work that rewires your identity and recalibrates your brain and strips away the noise that keeps most leaders trapped in survival. And you can find out inside of our newsletter. A lot of the stuff doesn't get onto the public square. It's the deeper neuroscience, the emotional source code practices, the material reserved only for those who are ready for something closer to initiation rather than information. If you feel the pull, I'm suggesting you might want to trust that, reach out on DoveBaron.com. That might be a good idea, because really what I'm hearing, Trev, is that this willingness to trust that there's something more than this rational, logical pitch within us where it's holding. You've got to be rational. And I just don't know that that's true.
No, and I think you also touched on a very important thing that, and I say this too, to my masterminds or the memberships at trevorgblake.com. People who are listening to this show, Dove, oftentimes just don't know how rare a human they are, how rare a spirit they are, because 99.999% of people are glued to this, their cell phone. I keep bumping into them all the time. I walk everywhere, so I keep bumping into them. And they're living life vicariously through others.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. Nothing wrong with it. I'm not judging. That's a choice. As long as you don't complain or criticize or gossip or troll, as long as you just accept it. People who listen to these shows, people who watch the shows that you do, that I do, they know that there's something special about them and they can feel it inside. I call this the torso one. So it's the connection between the brain's nervous system, the heart's nervous system, the solar plexus nervous system. And our scientific fact that makes people sit up and listen a bit is that there are more messages sent from the heart to the brain than the other way around, believe it or not, and then from the solar plexus, twice as many as both. And so that makes this torso one, I think of it like a Harry Potter thing or a Space Wolf saber or something. This powerful thing, it feels like for a lot of people who attend shows like this, that it's throbbing and it's calling to you and it's saying you're so much more than you think. So pick something up, one little thing, just pick it up, but start at that
point. That's your mom. In your world, that's your mom. What you just described is your mom connected you to that trusting that you are more than your environment, more than your quote, as you said, quicksand, that you're more than the milieu you grew up in. And for me, it was the same thing. Everybody thought I was nuts. I'm like 14 going, I'm not going to live here anymore. And they're like, oh yeah, where are you going? I'm going to live in another country. No, you're not. My mother's telling me I'm thick, that I'm not doing well at school. I'm having all kinds of problems with dyslexia and ADHD, et cetera, et cetera. But I was not thinking in their way. And I think that what you're talking about is people recognizing that in them. Just because you don't think like them doesn't make you a failure. In fact, it's probably what makes you a success. Look at Richard Branson. Look at Steve Jobs. We can all judge them in different ways about who they were and how they were. But these are not people who necessarily fit the box of where they were supposed to go. They decided on doing something else. And if you're smart enough, you figure out who can help you and you choose to have people who can help you. You go, okay, I don't know how to think like that. Can I hang out with Trevor? Can't think like that. Can I hang out with Dove? How do I do that? What do I do to get into that world and have that input? This is so important, as opposed to going, oh, I'm stupid and I don't know how to do this. Listen, I'm shit at algebra. I'll never be any good at it. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. But if I need it, I can hire somebody. I can hire AI to do it if it comes to that.
Yep. And we were talking about this before. We're both having an affair with AI right now in a positive way. It's funny, as you were talking, I was thinking, well, who did I hang out with? And it was biographies. I hung out with biographies. And I used to hide in the public library because we moved to North Wales. We escaped to North Wales. We got evicted. It was at a time when the Welsh hated the English. The English are buying holiday homes. Prices are going up. Farmers can't afford to buy. Let's go burn the house down. And all of that was going on. So because I was English and noticeably, not just English, but a Liverpudlian English, they come after me with cricket bats and stuff like that. And so I'd hide in the library and I just read autobiographies and biographies because everything was alphabetical order in the reference library, A's and B's. And so I read all that. And when I think about that, that was like hanging out in a mastermind for me. And as you were talking, I was just thinking, she said, I'm no good at algebra. I was thinking, I still read religiously as many biographies as I can. And I just read Anthony Hopkins' biography. It came out November the 4th. It's really, really good. His parents thought he was as thick as two short planks. They were so worried about him because he was hopeless, hopeless, hopeless in school. And he did say one day, he turned around to his dad and said, I'm going to show you, and you remember this. It just turned out that he could read with this beautiful resonant voice. And he went on stage and people said, wow, you've got something. And then after that, it took off. But before that, to him, school was kind of pointless because it's not how his brain works. It's not how his soul is wired.
You hit a point again, which is, I am a great believer in resonance and that you become what you marinate in. And so if I'd have stayed in that environment that I'd have been in, I wouldn't be this guy. I'm a great believer in Hugh Everett III's quantum realities, multidimensional reality, 10 field. And to me, there's another version of me that still lives in Salford, who's never left. And I have conversations with him. I use him for my decisions because whatever he would decide, I want to go the other way. And it's by who have I decided to be around? I've traveled the world to study with great spiritual masters and great business masters and all these great people. That has formed and sculpted my psyche in ways that has allowed me to do that. And you did it through autobiographies at a young age. And this is what's really important for people. I know we're already at the end of part one of the show, and I want to make sure that people can find out about you, Trev. Please tell people where they can find out more about you. I know you have a bunch of resources, how they can find out about those too.
Yeah, on this side of my life, and like you, Dove, when you understand how to interact with energy, you end up playing in different fields. So I'm also a writer, also a movie producer, and I'm a serial entrepreneur. But when it comes to how to interact with energy in a more beneficial way so you can get the life you want, not living the one you don't want, everything's at trevorgblake.com. So it's just my name, Trevor, T-R-E-V-O-R, G for my middle name, which is George, B-L-A-K-E, Blake. It's like three first names. So trevorgblake.com. I put loads of freebies on there. Most of the back-end team that I've got get really annoyed with me. There's a reason for it. Obviously, like you, I want everyone to get into a membership because in my day, in your day probably too, there was no internet, there were no masterminds. And so biographies were the only way. But today, we have in our biological computer, you've mentioned source code a few times, Dove. So we have chips here and here. Reticular activation system, mirror neurons. And so we can learn by observing other people or hanging out with other people. We can pick the best practices without having to do anything. So I encourage everybody, whether it's Dove's or someone else's or mine, get into a mastermind, get onto the website and pull as many of the freebies as you can. So trevorgblake.com, everything's there.
We'll make sure that that's posted in the show notes. If you didn't catch it, don't worry, it'll be there. We're going to be back in just one click for more of our delicious conversation with Trevor Blake. So stay curious, my friends. Stay curious. See you in one click. Welcome back to part two of our delicious conversation with our guest, Trevor George Blake. He launched his first company from nothing on a laptop and converted it into a nine-figure exit. He is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Three Simple Steps. And we've been talking about how he came to be who he is, his journey from being born in financially poor background with a father who was unemployed, unemployable, a mother who taught him to see the light inside of himself and inspire him to live beyond the environment he came up in. We talked about him joining the Royal Navy and then becoming a physicist, as well as then on to starting an entrepreneurial business and then finding his way into the personal development world. And that was kind of where we finished. And there's an interesting thing here, Trevor, and I think you and I talked about it in our previous conversation. My wife and I owned a personal development company for 15 years. Put on big events with all these people who come from around the world. And eventually I closed the company. I didn't sell it. I closed it because I felt it would be unintegral to sell it because I felt like I was in the recycling business. People were coming for another hit, as you were talking about in part one. And there was a need to really make transformational work something that people could actually do and make a difference. Talk to us about moving into that world, because again, that's a world that's very different from where you were. You worked for Big Pharma. It couldn't be further apart. The Navy, physicist, Big Pharma. You're the anti-personal development guy. And then you got this transformational experience. Tell us a little bit about how you got into that world.
Well, you hit the nail on the head with the anti word. I'm something of an anti-expert. As a scientist, it's really important to have facts to base something on. Okay, we've figured out how this thing works. We don't always get it right, but at least we're trying to base it on something, not just create feel-good ideology like law of attraction and other nonsense like that. They're not real laws, by the way. So for me, with physics, we base fact as the laws of energy. And so it gives us somewhere to work from. That then leads us into what people call quantum physics today. That's almost become a religion. That bothers me a bit. But in quantum physics, you also mentioned previously, in order for anything to exist, it has to exist in at least 10 dimensions. We're talking 28 now, actually, although it's not proven. So that side of the world always fascinated me. And then as I've gone through my career, my various, I don't know what we call it, various adventures, like everybody else, I'm completely flawed. It's not about being perfect or being a saint. I get flawed like everyone else does. I get knocked back all the time. How do I overcome that? And I developed tools and techniques of how to overcome that. And I wanted to share that. But one reason why I didn't was because of my dislike of the inauthenticity that exists in self-help and personal development. I think you're hinting at that about the recycling thing. What most of it is doing is just making people feel better about the life they have. And at the heart, most people want a better life. And there is a program. It is programmable. It is based on fact. It is based on science. I love what they write about. I love what they had to say, like the late Wayne Dyer. They were very inspiring and they made me feel good. I got dopamine hits reading their books or listening to, this is aging me, listen to the cassette tape in the car.
I listened to their LPs. Okay. I'm telling you, honestly, I had LPs of some of those guys.
Oh, I feel so much better you said that now.
So now you can feel like a nipper.
Yeah, this is brilliant. Let's keep going. So what they say, I want to believe so much. I want it to be true, but there's no tool. There's no technique that I can apply tomorrow that's going to bring me closer to it. And that really frustrated me. And I used to bang on about this like crazy to Lynn, who wasn't interested in any of that world at all. She's a nurse. She's very pragmatic, very down to earth. So I used all the techniques that is in my book, Three Simple Steps right now, and the transformation course. So Three Simple Steps is a 2-hour read, is a good foundation. The transformation course is a 30 to 40 day experience. You have to do the work. There's work to be done here. You can't sit in the chair and let law of attraction come in and make you a great day. It's not going to happen. So there's work to do. And the reason there's work to be done is what we just touched on previously, which is we have to recode this. We've got to change the source code because these two chips, and only humans have these chips. Some reptiles, one group of primates have that one. So we're pretty unique. And what the problem with it is, I call it the enemy within. So it keeps us in a loop. It's why people experience, oh, not another bad relationship, or oh, I've run out of money again. It's a loop, it's a loop, it's a loop. The simple analogy I like to use is like a Google algorithm. And so just like Google watches what you watch and gives you more of what you just watched. So these two watch what we pay attention to and give us more of the same. And that's fine if we're happy and in quicksand and this is the only life we want is to be on our cell phone. That's fine. If no one listening to this or watching this wants that life, they want something better, something bigger, something bolder. They want to be a better version of themselves. And so you have to change this source code that we were born with and that most people ignore their whole lives. You've compared it to the iPhone. I think we're on iPhone 17 or something now. I don't know how many upgrades of software. Our human computers pretty much are the same as they were when we were born, unless we do something about it. So I've been banging on about this for years and years and years. And then I've used all of these tools and techniques to have just a blast of a life. So I started my first company with a few $100. I didn't know what I was doing. I had no connections. I hadn't got the money to hire anybody, let alone making the decision not to hire anybody. But I had the dream. I know how intentions work. I know how stupid and foolish goal setting can be. It can help you get across a pond in stepping stones, but it's not going to shoot you across an ocean. And most of us who have a dream, it's way away from where we are right now, including my current dreams are way beyond where I am right now. And so I had this mechanism to get there. And with my first company, I applied it because I didn't know what else to do. And so in 5.5 years, I went from zero to 105.5 million, sold the company. And then I said to Lynn, foolishly, I said, I'm going to take a sabbatical. She rolled her eyes. And then 2 weeks later, I was in the kitchen pacing up and down. And she held out a kitchen knife and she said, Trevor, I can't tell you exactly what she said because there's a lot of expletives. She's from England too. So she said, Trevor, if you don't start that book, I'm going to kill you with this. So that very night, I went down to the airport to pick her mum up. She was going to stay with us. So we were living in Southern California. Mum was living in Spain at the time. And I was killing time in Hudson bookstores and I saw a brand new self-help book. And on the front cover was this guy. It was just a self-portrait. One of the things you'll notice about my book, Three Simple Steps, is I'm not on it. It was a portrait.
It is the plainest cover in history, just so anybody wants to know. If you're looking for it and you think, that can't be it, that's it. It's the plainest cover. It looks like a 7-year-old designed the cover.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what it's supposed to be. It's three simple steps.
That's exactly what it's supposed to be. So this other book, this guy, he's got a stained glass window behind him and he's got a halo over his head. And I thought, I'm going to vomit. Right. So I flicked through it, full of religious quotes taken out of societal context, which is nonsense, right? I'm not saying the religious quotes are nonsense, but taking them out of an agricultural society, applying them to how we live life today is a bit of a stretch, even though Oprah likes to talk about it or something. And that's how it catches on. So I wrote the book, Three Simple Steps. So the way I did Three Simple Steps was, I thought, I'll write the book. I'll make it like 2 hours. So if you're a road warrior like me, like I was once, you'll pick it up. You can read it on a 2-hour flight. You've got it. You've got some tools and techniques you can apply tomorrow. Just basically three steps. And it'll change your life forever. And I didn't do anything other than that. No promotion or anything. So if I have a gravestone, this is going on the gravestone. For one afternoon, and I can't remember the date, but it was 2012, I was more popular than 50 Shades of Grey on the Amazon top list for 4 hours, maybe. Okay, I've made it. I have replaced dungeon sex with trying to change your life for the better.
Dungeon sex with transformation. Okay.
So that was it. So it became a New York Times bestseller, I think 3 times. And then after that, it's just word of mouth. And It's all over the world. It's in six languages. It's an amazing story because I haven't tried to make it happen. I've used the same tools and techniques for my business. If you set it up right, it'll take care of itself. It's energy. It flows. It flows right.
Okay. So you've entered into that world, as I said, and then you've written the book, but then you've created this transformational experience. That seems like a bit of a stretch too, because again, a lad from Liverpool, Navy, physicist, big pharma. You write the book on personal development, which is in itself a stretch because it's not the world you were in. And then you've created this transformational experience. Talk to us about how that came about. I know because I built lots of workshops. It's a lot of work to build something, even from a book.
So it was the opposite. It was probably the easiest thing I've ever done because it came to me. I remember I was flying on a plane one time, and it was at the time when a book called Celestine Prophecy was out. And it just went crazy. It formed a cult. And I was on a plane one time getting my seat, and I looked around and everyone around me was reading the same book. You don't see that very often. You could imagine it's in business class. There's no such thing as first class domestically anymore, sadly. So, you know, in the sort of 12 seats, maybe 10 of them are reading the same book. And I was fascinated by that. And I picked it up and I enjoyed it. Didn't get it the same way everyone else did, maybe, but I still enjoyed it. And so after I wrote Three Simple Steps, I started to notice a very similar thing happening in that cults were forming around Three Simple Steps. And I would get people contact me saying, we've got a book club about this. We've got a mastermind about this. And would you be a guest and everything? And I thought, that's fine. But the person who's leading it doesn't know the source code. So they're teaching the tools and techniques from their perspective, not from the perspective of someone that studied them, but for, at that point, 45 years.
But that's the point, isn't it? I just want to put a button in that for a minute, because this is the problem with self-help. People used to come to my workshops and my wife say, oh my God, another one. And it would be, another one wants to be Dove. They want to go away and teach what I just taught them, but they haven't got 40 years of experience. They haven't got my childhood. They haven't got the things I've gone through. They haven't got the messes I've been with. They haven't got the wear and tear of it. And it's an intellectual concept. And so you were confronted with that. And that must have been challenging, because it would be easy to say, well, yeah, I mean, this is a franchise business now.
Yeah, I did the opposite. It scared me a little bit. It was a bit like people who have only ever eaten a chocolate chip cookie and want to become bakers. You've got a lot of learning and a lot of work to do. You got a lot of study to do before you can be in a position to teach anyone else to bake a cookie. I use a lot of bacon analogies because my mum taught me to bake because she was afraid that she would die and we'd starve to death. Because my dad didn't know even where the kettle was, let alone how to make a cup of tea. And I find it very cathartic. And so I was thinking of it in those terms, in terms of a bacon analogy, in that I am going to have to create ambassadors to the Three Simple Steps. So anyone who wants to teach the Three Simple Steps has to know it at a similar depth than I know it. So I created the transformation experience, and that again took on a life of its own. I think up to this point, I'm guessing, I never look at numbers, but I think it's about 6,000 people have graduated. It's funny how many people start and how many people finish. So probably 20,000 started and maybe 5,000 or 6,000 finished the first time. And then they become kind of an ambassador to it. So they understand the facts behind the tool and technique. So if you understand why a tool works, it's so much easier to teach it than just talking about it. I imagine it's a bit like, and I've never been, but going to a Tony Robbins seminar and walking on coals and getting a certificate that says, now you're a life coach. No, you're not. You don't know anything about life yet. Neither did he, by the way, because he started himself out at, what, 16? He's never done a real job like most of the world has done. Not that that's wrong, just that you're going to have the facts. Right? So the transformation experience was created to give people the depth of understanding. And I was thinking about it. I was living in Seattle at the time and had a beautiful place with 5 acres and horses and dogs. We all walk together and we'll walk along the trails. And it just came to me. And I said, I'm going to do it. All the things I've pulled out of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of biographies that have formed these patterns of behavior I can see in my brain, I'm going to put it into the transformation experience. And it's been absolutely life-changing. What's the proof? Does it work? What's the proof? I started it in 2014 or 15, I think. I've never had a single person ask for the money back. Not one person in all that time. That's an incredible thing. So I'm very proud of it, as you can tell. I become more of a Liverpoolian as I get excited.
You talked about the books, the autobiographies. And I know that your bride is an artist. So when you think about specific books or works of art or pieces of music that have fundamentally influenced your own inner transformation, they're never brought up in public conversations. What would you say they are?
It's storytelling. It's not necessarily a book or a biography or a life story. It's a story within a life story. So for me, one of the most influential life stories I ever came across was Madame C.J. Walker. And she's been written out of American history. I'm living in America now. And if I mention Madame C.J. Walker to people around where I'm living here, who's that? Yeah. And here's a woman who was born to slaves. Slavery was quote unquote abolished, but you weren't allowed to get a job. You weren't allowed to own a knife and fork because they're considered weapons. You know, just this horrible life that you find yourself in. She's physically abused, made pregnant at 14. The person who made her pregnant disappears, and she's suffering from malnutrition. Her hair falls out because of it. She lives in a tree. And I was feeling hard done by at the time I read this because I'm getting bullied, right? It's nothing, nothing compared to what this woman went through. And of course, she's a slave or born a slave. So she's got the wrong gender and the wrong skin color for the time. And she's in the wrong place and she has nothing, no hope and no education. And she becomes America's first female millionaire. I was blown away by that as a kid. If I never heard any other story than that, that would be enough for me to stop whining about how cruel life is and to go and make something of myself. So in my life, it's always been these amazing stories. And so you very kindly mentioned that Jess is an artist, but that's not her story. I immediately fell in love with her. I've never dated in my life. So I've met two women, fell in love, hopelessly in love twice and done. She was born in a cult.
Mm-hmm.
And she escaped at age 17. Uneducated, untrained, no chance of going to college, taught herself to be an artist, had a dream of working for Disney one day, and ends up working for Disney for a few years before she went independent. What an inspiring human being Jess is. She doesn't sit there and tell me the story. I have to drag it out of her over time because a lot of it is really tough memories. I mean, you know, imagine being 17, escaping a cult, and your parents and your sibling completely turn their back on you and never speak to you again, ever. Yeah. And as you're walking down the street, the neighbors and the other people who are in the cult slap you across the face and spit at you. Imagine being 17 and have that happen. It makes me hiding in the library from the guys with the cricket bats seem a bit of a coward to me. So it's the storytelling that I think. So I can't imagine people come to your show and don't hear amazing stories. And it's the stories that inspire us to say, okay, I've been whining about the way my life is going, but it's nothing compared to what these other people have gone through. That's what biographies have done for me. Look what they did. And when I do that, even at my ripe old age, I think, do you know what? I've barely started. What have I been doing with my life? Why have I been so lazy? You know, there's so much more that can be done. So for me, it's always the storytelling part of everything that inspires me.
It's an interesting point, and I'll tell you why I think it's interesting. I remember a friend of mine coming to visit me, a very good friend of mine in Australia. He'd been a client of mine when I lived there, and he came to visit me in Canada. And it was about 3 years after I'd fallen off the mountain. And he said to me, where's the book? And I said, what book? And he goes, about the fall. And I'm like, I'm not writing about that. It's in my past. It doesn't matter. And he goes, you are so wrong. And I said, I'm bored with telling that story. He goes, you can be bored about talking about it in 50 years and it'll still inspire people. You need to tell this story. And I think this is part of the thing is that's the tall poppy syndrome. It's like, I don't want to be a big head. I don't want to be talking about me and my stuff. But it's understanding that there's a fragment of your story. It's not the whole thing. There's some piece of that. People go, oh my God, that's me. And I talk a lot about in my work about I recently lost my sister. And somebody asked me about it. And I said, I lost the last living witness to my childhood. And when you tell your story, you make other people a witness to it. And your story becomes a witness to their story. And when you watch a movie and you cry, it's because something in that movie is a witness to your experience. And when you tell that to somebody else, it's a witness to their experience. And this is how we all emotionally bond with each other, as you talked about, through the mirror neurons. We bond with each other. We connect with each other. We get the connections that we need through oxytocin that tells us we're not alone in this. We can come through it. And so I think storytelling is a very powerful and important thing that in our modern world we've minimized, that you talked about in the world before the industrial age was so important. We sat around the fires and we told those stories. That was our shows, if you will. And we can't afford to minimize that because it is the depth of inspiration that we need. But we all get caught up in the busyness of life and we're juggling the demands of the job and life and obligations. What is one specific daily action or habit that might require like 20 minutes or less that you guarantee will have the highest impact on their focus or the results, let's say over the next month, for somebody who is feeling like they're caught in that busyness.
It's probably the hardest one that people get. It's stopping doing for 20 minutes is really hard for a lot of people. And it's not that they're stopping doing stuff, you know, like making food for the kids and all that kind of stuff. It's not stopping that type of doing. It's stopping the mental doing. And so it's very hard for people to sit and do nothing without thinking about if somebody has just contacted them in social media or on the cell phone or something, or you put the cell phone down and you say, I'm going to sit here for 20 minutes and do nothing. And then it dings. You've got to be a superhuman strength to say, I'm not going to see who that was. So for me, you have to have the discipline of switching things off. That really helps me. I would be that person. If I see a ding, I'll just go and check what it is. See if it's important. It never is, but see if it's important. And so I switch everything off and I make sure every day I give myself at least 20 to 30 minutes. I do it first thing in the morning. It doesn't have to be. I just think it's easier. I call it taking quiet time. And the interesting thing was when I met Jess, she was a self-confessed workaholic. She worked really hard all the time. She was so burned out. And I've not tried to influence her at all. I've never said you shouldn't do this or you should do that at all. But I think, like you say, with the mirror neurons, observing how somebody else is living and enjoying the fruits of living that way, is she started to think, well, that's something I want. And so I noticed she started to switch off more often. And by switching off, she'll go and do a yoga instead of finishing a conference call. These conference calls we get involved in, we have to wait till everybody says it. So her thing is yoga now. That's what she's doing right now. She gave me the space in this room. So she'll take an hour yoga. She has someone that she follows that she likes. She's very advanced. She's tried to teach me, but I almost needed to go to the emergency room for getting in those knots and things. So what everyone can do for themselves is look in the mirror and say, don't I deserve 20 to 30 minutes of alone time just for me with nothing else on, no one else around? And then just treat yourself, whether it's going into the garden, sitting in a rocking chair, because this is what I learned in the biographies. And that's how Henry Ford got his great ideas, sitting in a rocking chair in the old farm. Whether it's doing some weeding or whatever, that's how Colt got his ideas from the past, just weeding a patch of grass. Or whether it's just sitting in a corner, just being quiet, or whether it's just having a little nap. That's what NASA requires its pilots to do, nap for 20 to 30 minutes. And what that does is it causes our brain to switch its neural pathways away from where it was going, away from the Google algorithm, and go, oh, hang on, there's nothing to pay attention to. So guess what? I'm going to pay attention to my host. And that creates all kinds of powerful influences, new neural pathways, new ways of thinking. And then all of a sudden you come out of it after 20 minutes and you go back to the world. And as you're heading back to the world, you get this aha moment and you go, oh my God, why didn't I think of that 2 days ago when I needed it? Why did I spend 4 hours in that business meeting trying to solve this puzzle? I've just got the answer. So that's the best treat anyone can give themselves to start to reboot the source code.
It's very interesting that, of course, every great philosophy talks about some form of meditation, breath work, et cetera, et cetera. The latest research on neuroscience is that you need to allow yourself to feel boredom, 10 to 20 minutes a day. And we are a society that boredom is so frowned upon. So like, oh, you can't be bored. But actually willing boredom, which is different than I'm bored because I'm doing monotonous thing. I'm willing to be bored, which is allowing the neural pathways to open up, allowing the greater level of thinking, allowing, as you said, a flushing of the mind in a different way. And I like to do it through gardening. When somebody asked me, what would you do if you weren't doing what you do? And I'm like, eh, no. And my wife goes, don't be an idiot. You know what it'd be. And I go, what? And she goes, you'd be a gardener. And it's true. Even in the winter, I love to go, and I live in a high rise and I have plants in my house, but I still go around and I'm deadheading and I'm watering and I'm doing little, because I don't have to think about that thing I'm present with. And there's a difference between being present with versus thinking. I'm just present with this plant and I'm looking at the roots and I'm looking at, does it need water? And that willingness is so important. As we come towards the end of the show, I want to ask you a question. I love to ask people like yourself, and I think it's because of an exercise I did with myself many, many years ago. And that is, if you could go back in time, you can time travel. I'm not going to ask you the question everybody asks you, which is, what's the advice you would give your little self? Boring. If you could go back in time to your younger self, to that Trevor who's probably 8, 9, maybe as old as 10, and you could show him the life you have, what would he think, what would he feel about the life you have?
Oh, it would be an immediate, I hope I made my mom proud. If my 10-year-old self was to look at where I am now, with all the mistakes I've made and all the screw-ups as we all have and the rest of it, I think I made my mom proud. I know I made Lynn proud. And I hope I'm making Jess proud. But for me, that's my biggest motivation. I've been lucky enough to be surrounded by this three female power thing, whereby they've all made me or inspired me to want to be slightly better tomorrow than I am today, and slightly better today than I was yesterday. And that's a priceless thing that you can't put a money number on that. The 10-year-old would probably smile and say, oh, you know, mom would be very proud. And that'd be enough for me.
So what does proud mean? What's the meaning of proud to you?
That I listened to her advice, that she didn't waste a breath on me. She would tell me stuff. And sometimes we had secret conversations that she didn't tell my siblings. She just would tell me things, and sometimes spiritual things that weren't allowed to be talked about openly. And I think she'd just be proud that I listened and then acted on it. And of course, messed up as much as I didn't. But overall, yeah, she'd be very proud.
What would your dad say if you go back in time to when you're about 10 and you talk to your dad at that time and you can show him the life you have?
He would say, sorry, I got you wrong, son.
Did he think you were his son, meaning you would step into his role?
No, I think I lived the life that he wanted to live. He'd lived a very different life to the one I lived. I was blessed to grow up in peace. He grew up in the Second World War and was forced to evacuate from Liverpool to live in the country with a strange family for the most formative years in your life, from the age of 11 to 16. You know, he didn't see his mum and dad during that whole time, and Liverpool's getting bombed and he's safe in the country and fell in love with the country. So when he came back and then got conscripted and spent 2 years in the Air Force, he was a very different human being than the one that started out. So I've always kept that in mind, that the way he lived his life was based upon the environment he allowed to influence himself with, and that's not his fault. But I think being able to observe that of my father, it gave me the motivation to say, I don't want that to happen to me. I don't want to become a product of the environment that the government's given me or that my parents have given me. I want to make my own way in life. So when I used to talk like this a little bit, when we had these conversations around the dining table, because we always dined together, I mean, there's no such thing as trays in front of a TV because we didn't have a TV. So when we had these conversations, he would kind of tone me down a bit. Don't get too big for your britches. Don't get too ambitious. And I think it's because in his life, he'd been ambitious and he got knocked down all the time because of the war and because of what happened to families during the war. He had to deal with different circumstances. He and I, we didn't get on great. As it turns out, he wasn't my actual biological father and he knew that. I learned it eventually. So I understand the tension that could have been there at some point, and why my brain was wired slightly differently to his. But he'd look back, I don't know whether he'd be proud or not, but he certainly would look back and think, you're a lucky kid because you've lived the sort of life that I really wanted to live.
Do you really think it was luck?
No, he would think it was luck.
Right.
Oh, no, I know it's not luck. No, no.
Because you used that word at the beginning. You'd said you feel like you're very lucky.
I think I'm lucky in the family I was born into. I think I was lucky to have... Well, okay, lucky's the wrong word. You're right to call me out on that, because the difference between me feeling lucky and perhaps my siblings feeling unlucky is how we observe the same situation. So they observe it probably with a sense of, this is unfair. And I would observe the same situation with a sense of learning something from it and maybe not making that mistake again, or maybe learning from that mistake. So I think you're right. I think I use the word lucky casually, I think because it's comfortable. But the truth is, there's never a reason to rely on luck. Per se, the mirror neurons and the reticular activation system, where we can learn by observation and then we can choose. And if we don't do the observation thing, we don't get to choose.
Well, Trev, it's been an absolute pleasure and an honor, sir. Thank you so much for being with us.
That was so much fun. Thank you.
Please tell everybody where they can find out more about you and all of your wonderful resources.
TrevorGBlake.com. Everything is there. And there's a bunch of freebies, so just grab what you can.
We'll make sure that that link is, of course, posted in the show notes. So if you didn't catch it, don't worry, it'll be there. Just scroll down. Trev, thanks for being with us. I hope you'll stay with us to the end. And for you, dear listener, remember, those who control the meaning for the tribe also control the movement of the tribe. Leaders who are committed to positively shaping the political and business landscape know that they must tap into what drives human behavior. I'm Dov Barron. I work with elite leaders across industries who are committed to soulfully guiding the destiny of the world, showing businesses, teams, and leaders how to harness their emotional source code to move their tribe. Because unified, actualized meaning is the single monolithic difference between mediocrity and greatness for individuals and for companies. Remember, we need your help in staying relevant, so please go to wherever it is you tune into the show from. Do us a favor, rate, review, and subscribe to the show. And of course, a big thank you to everybody who is a regular listener for sharing the show with everybody you know. Till next time, stay curious, my friend. Stay curious about the life you're living. Is it really yours? Or is it the one you've accepted? Have you accepted ideas about having to work harder and hustle more, when in truth, what you really need to do is to listen more to that inner guidance that sits within you? I'm Dov Barron. I'm here to assist you tapping into your deepest meaning to reach that next level of clarity, focus, purpose, and profit in your business, in your life, and your leadership impact. And I am out.